In the lead up to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, there were warnings that Russia might try to employ so-called deepfakes, high-tech manipulated videos, as an information warfare strategy. Sure enough, earlier this month, a deepfake appeared.
Шановні захисники, бути президентом виявилося не так вже легко.
The video shows Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky speaking into a camera, telling Ukrainian soldiers to lay down their arms and surrender to the Russians, which never actually happened. This was a phony clip, meant to fool people into thinking Zelensky had given up the fight.
But the funny thing is, it was pretty impotent. It didn't work. It didn't trick anyone. It was detected very quickly and debunked very quickly.
Noah John Siracusa is a professor of math and data science at Bentley University, and the author of a book about how algorithms can both create and prevent misinformation like deepfakes. He thinks this particular deepfake effort was a little silly, because it was easily refuted. Even to the naked eye, it wasn't all that convincing. And right after the video appeared, the real Zelensky made a statement assuring Ukrainians his resolve was strong. And so, in this case, the deepfake was immediately thwarted. For some, the fact that this video was so simple to dismiss suggests that deepfakes aren't yet something we should be worrying much about. For others, this Zelensky video was troubling. It felt like yet another step down a dangerous path, toward a moment when a more effective deepfake will have tragic, real-world consequences. But Noah thinks there's something both of these camps are missing.
The incident seems to highlight the potential power of a deepfake, that it could be used to dramatic effect if it was convincing enough, if it was deployed in the right way. Are you worried that a future deepfake video could have some kind of profound, terrible impact on the world?
I'm worried, but the point I'd like to raise is we don't just need to look to the future. If we look to the past, there's already been some pretty tricky situations where videos have been out that to this day, we still don't know if they were deepfakes or not. There's this kind of idea that, oh, because the Zelensky one was very low quality and we caught it right away, it means somehow all of deepfake technology is just not there yet. And, you know, as AI develops, one day we won't be able to tell truth from fiction and then the problem will really hit us. But I think it's more subtle than that because it really depends on the context. It's not just the technological issues. It's not like, oh, deepfakes aren't there yet, and in a few years, they'll be great and we won't know what's true. It's really how they're used that's so confusing.
Today on the show, we keep waiting for the big deepfake moment to arrive. But will we even know it if it does? Or has it just maybe already happened? And what if, stay with me, deepfakes aren't so bad after all? Could they actually be put to use as a force for good, not evil? I'm Seth Stevenson, in for Lizzie O'Leary, and you're listening to What Next TBD, a show about technology, power, and how the future will be determined. We'll be back in a moment.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
Let's go back in history a little bit. Using faked images as a dirty trick in politics or in conflict situations, it's not actually new, right? It's been happening sort of since the invention of photography.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, there's some funny old historical examples, like even Abraham Lincoln has this photo where he looks kind of heroic and masculine. And it turned out that they pasted his face on actually the body of a notorious pro-slavery advocate. And the reason they did that is Lincoln had kind of a gangly form and he didn't look very masculine. They wanted to make him look more heroic. At a superficial way, the easiest way to say it is we've had the ability to do that with photos, as you said, since the beginning of photos. And really what deepfake technology, which is based on artificial intelligence and neural networks, really the difference now is we can do that with videos.
That realm we live in with Photoshop that we've already been existing in, where we look at a fashion magazine cover and we just assume it's Photoshopped. I mean, in one sense, that's not really okay. I mean, that can have real effects on things like beauty standards to just accept that we're going to let people Photoshop and make fake images like that. Should we let ourselves just become acclimated to this stuff?
It is very problematic, right? But the key is who's being harmed, right? If a deepfake came out about President Biden and it, you know, influenced American politics, I think there'd be a strong reaction. But if there's a slow erosion, like with, you know, as you said, beauty standards, and millions of people's self-esteem starts going through the gutter, it's more of an external cost and it's more distributed. So it's harder to fight back. It's, you know, there's sort of a lot of harm spread over a lot of people rather than one singular event. And I'm a little bit worried that that's kind of the situation with deepfakes. We keep waiting for the one singular event. And, you know, we thought maybe the Russian invasion would produce such a thing, and so far it hasn't.
But in the same way that we kind of forget that fake altered photographs have been in politics and conflict forever, it seems like we keep talking about the horizon of how some deepfake video is going to eventually cause a catastrophe. We're like, we're waiting for some big destabilizing moment. But in fact, haven't we already seen incidents around the world where the existence of deepfakes can have dramatic consequences?
You're right that we keep waiting for, like, where's the big moment when a deepfake fools us all? Well, part of the answer is if it fooled us all, we wouldn't know it was a deepfake. That's part of the challenge. It's not like we're going to all be fooled and then a week later someone says, haha, got you, it was a trick. The good deepfakes might still be out there. For instance, the African nation of Gabon, the president Ali Bongo in late 2018 suffered a stroke, disappeared from public eye. And his government said, oh, you know, he has the stroke, he's recovering. But if you look at their constitution, there's a time limit. I forget if it's 4 or 6 weeks. If the president's unfit to lead for this period of time, they have to have a snap election, which means the government could lose power. And people kept saying, where is he? So the government released this on social media, a recorded message. It was about 2 minutes of the president speaking on New Year's, January 1st, 2019. And he, you know, gives his New Year's address. But it looks very odd.
Gabonais, Gabonais. I want to show us, permettez-moi de vous adresser à toutes et à tous.
In the video, President Ali Bongo sits at a table and speaks directly into the camera. But he looks different than he had in previous appearances. His movements are slightly unnatural. Parts of his face seem frozen. His skin is weirdly smooth and unfurrowed.
Right away, people start to say, hey, this is strange, and actually, one of his political opponents, the guy who ran unsuccessfully against him in the previous two elections, he actually said, I think this is a deep fake. And the theory caught on. And the government didn't really directly address it. They didn't bring the president out in public, but they also didn't really have any evidence that it wasn't a deep fake. So we didn't know what's going on, and the military there attempted a coup.
Chers compatriotes, le message à la nation du chef de l'État, Ali Bongo Ondimba.
The coup began within about a week of the video's release. The soldiers who launched the coup, bolstered by the deepfake theory, said they believed the president was actually incapacitated and that no one was in control of the country.
Un malade dépourvu de plusieurs de ses facultés physiques et mentales.
The coup was foiled within a day. The president subsequently made public appearances, but he looked frail and unhealthy. 2 years later, the incident remains murky. We still don't know exactly what happened.
Here's two possible histories that could have happened. One was he really was incapacitated. He was unfit to lead. Legally, there should have been an election. He could have lost power. And the government deceived the population by using this deepfake. And they basically held office by successfully using a deepfake that to this day we haven't really caught. Here's the other possible history. He had a stroke. You know, it can cause partial muscle paralysis. It can affect the way your face looks. It can affect your speech patterns. It can affect your blinking rate. So another very plausible history is that it's not a deepfake. He had a stroke. He was speaking the best he could, and it took him many months to recover and eventually did. We don't know what the reality is.
Some auditors who've run the video of the president through software analysis say they have a high degree of confidence it wasn't fake. But one of the problems here is that, in some ways, it doesn't matter if it was fake or not. The proliferation of deepfakes throws every video into doubt, because any video can at this point be semi-plausibly accused of being a deepfake.
That's terrifying, right? That a politician can be caught having an affair or, you know, doing some corrupt thing, and they can just say, no, that's not me, that was deepfaked. How can we ever prove that they're wrong?
Just on the technical level, when it comes to fighting deepfakes, the first thing is the struggle to identify them. How good are they? Are they at this point able to trick even people using high-tech approaches to identifying them, or are they not quite there yet?
Well, that's a very delicate question because it's an arms race. The methods that are used to generate these are the same methods that are used to detect these. So as the algorithms get better at detecting, they also get better at generating. Sometimes there are some competitions like Facebook and some other organizations collected a whole bunch of deepfakes and a whole bunch of authentic videos. And they said, all right, let's have a public data competition. And people come with algorithms and they see how, you know, what percentage you can identify correctly. And I forget the winners at the time, this is maybe a year or two ago, got something like 80%. So that's great, right? You're doing much better than random guessing. But it also means any one particular video, you don't have a heck of a lot of confidence that the algorithm did it correctly. In other words, it'll catch a lot, but there'll be a lot of false positives and a lot of false negatives. It's not up to the level where we can, you know, fully trust what the algorithm says.
So there's the technological arms race when it comes to fighting these. What about regulatory or policy approaches to fighting deepfakes? Are there laws that govern the use of deepfakes? Are there people working on regulations that would help prevent some kind of deepfake disaster from happening?
It's happened at a local level. So California has something that's very limited. So it's something like 6 weeks prior to an election, if a deepfake is used in a deceptive manner and there's not a disclaimer, that's illegal. There has been progress outside of political realms, like use of deepfakes to make non-consensual pornography. That's just sort of so blatantly horrendous that it's a little bit easier to regulate it. But in the kind of political realm, it is a form of speech and it's difficult. There's also the issue of provenance, right? Some hackers uploaded the Zelensky video to a Ukrainian newspaper. So what, are you going to charge the Ukrainian newspaper? It's not their fault. The people who shared it on social media, they don't know. It's not their fault. So who at the end of the day is going to suffer from, even if you created these laws, who's going to be held responsible?
When we come back, are there use cases for political deepfakes that aren't objectionable or maybe even desirable?
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket. So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
In the recent presidential election in South Korea, one of the major candidates had a deepfake version of himself. The deepfake would appear in videos, making jokes and speaking to voters. This was fully authorized by the candidate. Everything his deepfake alter ego said was carefully scripted by his communications team. One Wall Street Journal story suggested the deepfake was actually wittier and more likable than the real thing. And perhaps ominously, this deepfake augmented candidate won. He's now the president-elect of South Korea. Should every candidate create a deepfake doppelganger? Or is this a worrisome trend that we should try to nip in the bud?
That's a really interesting middle ground of an ethical debate of where's the line of when this is acceptable. And in my opinion, you know, it's very dangerous to kind of oversimplify. But at the end of the day, for me, the line really is deception. The South Korean example you mentioned is interesting. It reminds me a few years earlier, there was probably one of the first uses of deepfakes in politics that anyone noticed, which happened in India. A candidate was campaigning and he spoke one language and he wanted to reach people who spoke other Indian languages, and they deepfaked him. So his campaign team, they had him record a message and then they sort of used deepfakes to kind of lip sync him to make it look like he was speaking those other languages. And you could see one argument is they're trying to deceive and trick people to make it seem like he appeals to more people than he does. Or you could say he's trying to connect to more people. You know, how's that different than subtitling?
The examples of politicians using deepfake versions of themselves to shape their image. So this raises a possibility for me. And you're at a college. I want you to get a little bit sophomore dorm room with me here for a second. What if there was a real person, but they just never left their house, never went on the campaign trail, never changed out of their pajamas, and they just campaigned like as a deepfake, right? Where everything was perfectly scripted because their team could control it, and you know, they would never sort of like sweat or have any of the problems that a real person would have. Is that, I don't know, is that okay? Could we handle that? Is that, I don't know.
If this was someone pulling a prank and tricking us, I'm not okay with that. But if someone were open and honest, let's say they had an autoimmune condition and it's during a pandemic and it's literally not safe for them to go out, why should we only have people who have, you know, robust immune systems able to campaign? That doesn't seem fair. That doesn't seem right. And we might be missing out on, you know, really wonderful politicians. So, and, you know, it depends on the context, but I would say there definitely are situations where what you described, you know, some people could have mobility issues. This could help them travel further. So I think there's situations where it absolutely would be more than right. It would be equalizing.
All right, let me lead you further down this primrose path. Now, what if they win? Could you have deepfake governance? Could you, I mean, where now you have like a committee of people behind the curtain and you've got the deepfake president out in front. I mean, how often do you really see Joe Biden in the flesh? Like, could you have a deepfake president?
Well, again, here's another really silly but maybe helpful example. A lot of politicians don't write their own speeches, right? They have speech writers. So someone who's part of the team has put these words together and they're a mouthpiece for it. Does it really make so much of a difference if that mouthpiece is the human manifestation, you know, if that's Joe Biden or if it's an animation? To me, what matters is the content and the ability to connect to the voters. You could say, oh, a deepfake is somehow less human, right? It's like having a hologram president. So, okay, it's less authentic, but it could be more personalized. Politicians in many ways are kind of figureheads, right? They all have staffers, they have teams. Congress people are not writing all these laws themselves. They have staffers do this. So they already are kind of the deepfake representation of their staff. It's not a deepfake, but, you know, they're channeling that information and presenting to the public. So the next iteration where a computer algorithm does this, I don't think it's as far-fetched as it seems at first. And I don't think it's as morally wrong as it seems at first. If it's done in a not terribly deceptive way, I wouldn't be surprised if that's where we're heading, and I'm not too alarmed by that.
Well, along those lines, going back to the Zelensky video, the FBI warned in advance that Russia would employ deepfakes as part of its information warfare strategy. So it seems like the video made those concerns look prescient. Is this just something we should always expect now and be ready for, even if it's something we wish would go away?
One reassuring thing I think we're already seeing with this invasion is people are already much more on the lookout than we were a few years ago as far as this general idea of misinformation and disinformation. It's in our public conversations. It's in the news, you know, especially with things like Francis Haugen, the Facebook whistleblower, and all these political hearings. As a society, hearing that these issues of misinformation are out there, that I think we're kind of primed to be extra vigilant. Not everyone, and it doesn't mean we'll be right all the time, but I think people in general are more on guard, and I think this has played a large role. And I think it's best to not think of deepfakes as its own separate entity, like, okay, we have to figure out how to address this. It's better to think of it as part of a larger story of we're swamped with information and misinformation, and it's become increasingly challenging to discern the two. And deepfakes are just kind of one more layer to that complex onion of information and misinformation. We're not going to solve deepfakes, and we're not going to be destroyed by deepfakes, but whatever challenges we're facing before are definitely going to be a little bit harder, and we're going to have to be a little bit more vigilant, but I think we are taking steps in those directions.
Noah John Siracusa, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Noah John Siracusa is a professor of math and data science at Bentley University. That's it for the show today. TBD is produced by Ethan Brooks. We're edited by Tori Bosch. Alicia Montgomery is the executive producer for Slate Podcasts. TBD is part of the larger What Next family. TBD is also part of Future Tense, a partnership of Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. We'll be back on Sunday with another episode. I'm Seth Stevenson. Thanks for listening.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.